now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day, another great week, in fact, in this greatest nation on God's green earth. It is the great week of our Thanksgiving holiday, and there seems to be a determined attempt from voices on the extreme left to undermine Thanksgiving, to try to basically destroy the whole idea of the holiday, which is that we have anything to be thankful for in this country. Instead, we should be feeling downcast and guilty and determined to wipe out anything that is distinctively American or is part of our national heritage. It's a sickness. And it's, of course, abated by horrible events like the mass murder. And yeah, it is a mass murder. You kill five people who you don't even know in a matter of moments. And by the way, 40 others hospitalized. It's a terrible thing. And now we're finding out information about the killer. And the amazing thing is, and I was trying this, when they released his criminal record, and they did, I started printing it out so that I have access to it. And I ran out of paper. I mean, literally, there is a criminal record here going back for 21 years for Darryl Brooks, who is the killer in Waukesha, who deliberately rammed his car in the midst of a Christmas parade. It's some of the people who were killed were members of a group called the Dancing Grannies. And they were doing, I mean, they're people who enjoy dancing as a form of exercise in their spare time. And they were part of this Christmas parade, which goes back for a half century in Waukesha, Wisconsin, which is a nice town. It's a 70,000 people, small town, relatively small city. But in any event, the idea that Dancing Grannies, who are coming out to entertain their grandchildren and their fellow citizens, get mowed down by this maniac who describes himself as an activist and a rapper. And he has not only a 50-page, that is not an exaggeration, a 50-page rap sheet, criminal record. He had just been released on bail, on $1,000 bail. Somebody's going to have to explain that. How does somebody who is this prolific and this habitual and this repeated a killer, how does he get out from his last arrest? His last arrest was one of the women with whom he has produced a child. He did not his wife, of course, but one of the women, he had beaten her up. And then he had been arrested for that. And then after he was released from the arrest from that, he tried to run her down with his car. And that occurred in November. He was released from prison on Friday. And then this weekend, this same weekend he was released on $1,000 bail, the guy runs through this crowd and injures scores of people and actually breaks and destroys and ends a number of lives. The entire thing is bizarre. And by the way, he found time during the time that he was out of jail after his release to post against the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict. Yeah, and by the way, mostly people who were fearful of a massive wave of national violence regarding Kyle Rittenhouse, that didn't happen. Happened in Portland, of course, but then again, that's just a number, a regular night in paradise down in Multnomah County, Oregon. I mean, what a nasty, nasty reality with all of that in behalf of the social justice cause. By the way, does anyone believe that this social justice cause is advanced by any of this? I'll tell you what will advance the cause of social justice and frankly be a tremendously meaningful this week, this Thanksgiving week, something that we can give thanks for, will be the final verdict, I believe, in the Ahmaud Arbery killing case. And the reason it's so important, and I think it ends up being vastly more important, more significant, more meaningful to the country than the Kyle Rittenhouse case, is because anyone who's been following this case at all, the people, the three defendants, are guilty. They're just clearly, unequivocally guilty. Now, I don't get to make that decision. You don't get to make that decision. The public doesn't get to make that decision. But the jury does and will. And the idea that some kind of white privilege is going to get them out, I think it's very unlikely. And can we as a country maybe come together when this is over and basically make it clear that a lot of these cases, the Rittenhouse case, had nothing to do with race? I mean, and it's totally absurd to say so. And for those people who talk about, oh, Kyle Rittenhouse got out because of white privilege, there'll be a completely different message in the Arbery case when these people get convicted and ultimately sentenced, and sentenced for a very long time. The point about supporting Kyle Rittenhouse and his right to a fair trial and his right to a self-defense is that in a rational basis, when you look at this thing, and even people in liberal media began to acknowledge that, well, it's very tough to make that, to overcome that self-defense. You'll see. They're also trying to use the claim of self-defense in the Ahmaud Arbery case. In fact, this was part of the prosecutor's, Linda Donikoski, who's done a terrific job. She gave this, pushing back on the self-defense claims, in her closing statement in the trial on the Arbery killing. This is clip one. Listen.
But where's the imminent use of unlawful force by Mr. Arbery? What force by what was he doing? He's running away from Mr. Bryan's truck. Mr. Bryan has already tried to hit him with the truck numerous times. He's trapped between two cars with no weapon, no way for anyone to help him, because there's nobody out there to help him. He's not threatening anybody. He's just running away from the man with the shotgun. Look at this. I mean, take a look at this. He's not even up to those mailboxes on the side. And that's Travis McMichael pulling that shotgun up. Well, what are they going to tell you? They're going to tell you what Travis said. Oh, he was running toward me. And I could tell he was going to attack me. Is that reasonable? Who brought the shotgun to the party? Who took the shotgun out of the car? Who pointed the shotgun? The guy's running away from them for 5 minutes.
Okay, look, the essential point that she's making about as forcefully as you can, and it's very forceful, is that it's a very different thing when you are running away as a future victim and people are pursuing you. How do you claim self-defense from somebody who's running away from you for 5 minutes? How is that self-defense? And the claim that, well, I thought he was going to attack me. That's not what a reasonable person would say. It will be a huge sigh of relief to the country when the criminal justice system does its job and we get a verdict on Arbery. And then the people who simply say it's all about race, well, what happened there? What happened there is America was being America again. It's a famous poem by the great black poet Langston Hughes, "Let America Be America Again." Recognize that this country in its soul is good, is decent, is generous, and is just. Now, what does the left say? They want to trash Thanksgiving. Why? We'll get to that and why they're so wrong coming up on The Medved Show.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
little bit later in this broadcast, I'll be very honored to welcome to the show somebody who's been on the show before, but someone I admire greatly. I think he's one of the clearest, most forceful thinkers in the United States. His name is John McWhorter. He's a professor at Columbia University and a prolific and very influential podcaster, and he has a new book, which is just devastatingly powerful, and it is an indictment of the entire insanity of woke culture. And part of what's wrong with woke culture, he doesn't even like the name, we'll talk to Mr. Professor McWhorter about that. Part of what's wrong with woke culture is the profound ingratitude, the stupidity of people who have the great privilege of living in this wonderful country. It's a wonderful country. And then step on it and smear it and try to kick it and smash it and try to make America look like hell and seem to be doing their best to besmirch not only this country's heritage, but this country's present and future. MSNBC, and for shame, for even broadcasting this, I understand that you say outrageous, stupid stuff, and this works sometimes on the right wing too, but it certainly works on the left wing. You say all kinds of absurd, stupid stuff, and you hope, well, boy, we're going to create a controversy and get people to listen in, and they'll be upset and excited. I don't want to do that, but I do want to give an answer, because I think one of the most important things that needs to happen in this country, if we are going to get back to what people like to think of as normal and toward the blessings of the American dream, that's going to require people having a more realistic sense of our history, not the sense of our distorted history, our false history, our phony history, which is peddled as science fiction by people like the 1619 Project. And that they are coming out now with a book that that they are selling. But Tiffany Cross on MSNBC was on with a true expert on the meaning of Thanksgiving. The expert's name is Gyasi Ross, who describes as described as an author, a rapper, an attorney, a speaker, and a storyteller. And this is what Gyasi Ross has to say about the idea of stuffing and biscuits on Thanksgiving. Listen, clip 8A.
With Thanksgiving right around the corner, I wanted to turn the mic over to turn the cross-connection favorite and my friend Gyasi Ross for this week's essay and his take on the real story of Thanksgiving and some history you probably never read in your school books.
The truth is, pilgrims did not bring turkey, sweet potato pie, or cranberries to Thanksgiving. They could not. They were broke. They were broken. Their hands were out. They were begging. They brought nothing of value. But they got fed. They got schooled. Thanksgiving. It makes sense. There is much for white Americans to be thankful for. But I'm still trying to figure out what indigenous people received of value. Instead of bringing stuffing and biscuits, those settlers brought genocide and violence. That genocide and violence is still on the menu, as state-sponsored violence against Native and Black Americans is commonplace, and violent private white supremacy is celebrated and subsidized.
Okay, they brought nothing. They brought nothing. And again, one of the things that is so important, and by the way, I have my new column in Newsweek, which is coming out tomorrow, is about that. One of the things that they brought was an alliance with the Wampanoag Indians, who were the other participants in the Thanksgiving feast. And when he says they were broke, they came over here to settle not a thriving city or a thriving civilization. The whole story was one of cooperation and friendship and alliance. And yes, it did involve, for many of the Indians in the area, conversion to Christianity, which is not something that people like to talk about because it involves religion, and people suggest that the Indians who were living at the time, that they had, that their system of civilization, their entire worldview, could not possibly benefit from anything that the Europeans had brought over. But the idea that they brought genocide is ridiculous. If anything, the history of the Plymouth Plantation, which is what they called, and by the way, please don't go into this thing about plantation means slavery. They didn't practice slavery. They weren't involved in slavery. They weren't involved in killing Indians. They were involved in saving the lives of Wampanoag Indians by allying with them against hostile Indian tribes who were enemies to both. And that's one of the most idiotic things about all of the romanticization of Native American life. Native American life was brutal, and it was terribly violent. It's not as if these were pacifistic people. They were very proud to be ferocious warriors. And by the way, the very first encounter that pilgrims had, and this is in my book, The American Miracle. You can read it. You can read the eyewitness accounts. There are two different eyewitness accounts, one by Edward Winslow, one by William Bradford. When they were first looking for a place to actually land and to try to survive in the cold in late November, it's early December of 1620, and they go off on an expedition on what's called a shallet. It's a little boat, not the Mayflower. It's a little boat that can take about a dozen guys, and they bed down for their first night. They were fired upon by Arabs. This is Arabs. by arrows. All apologies here right now. There were no Arabs in North America that we know of at the time. In any event, the idea is that is called First Encounter Beach. It's on Cape Cod. You can see it today. It is a historical monument. The first encounter was they were hearing howling of wolves, which was not reassuring to them. And then there was a minor Indian attack on this small group who they'd never met, had never had any contact with. So the idea that the Indians were open-handed, what they did is they negotiated in the past Thanksgiving feast. We don't know exactly what day of the month it was, but we know it was in 1621, and it was sometime in the autumn. It was the harvest period of time. The pilgrims had lost nearly half their people to starvation, to cold, to misery in the winter. No, they were not rescued by organized Indians, but they had a joint purpose. And the purpose was to live decent lives, maybe in harmony. We'll be right back on the MedVet Show. On the Michael Medved Show, talking about the declaration about Thanksgiving feasts and the history of Thanksgiving and the meaning of Thanksgiving by people on the extreme left, and yes, they are on the extreme left, Yossi Ross, who describes himself, identifies himself as a member of the Blackfeet tribe and the Suquamish tribe. He is also identifies as a graduate of Columbia Law School, and basically making the point that there's no part of American civilization for which anyone can be thankful to white people at all, at all. Instead of bringing stuffing and biscuits, those settlers brought genocide and violence. I mean, even in terms of the meal that they ate, and they had 3 days of celebrating in the original Thanksgiving, which is written about in Mount's Relation, which is a book by Edward Winslow, who was there and lived it. They did welcome, unexpectedly, 90 Wampanoag warriors who came, and when they found that there were far fewer pilgrims, there were only 53 who survived. Half of them died in the first winter. And when the Indians arrived, there clearly wasn't enough food, so they went out and got a deer. They may have gotten more than one. And that is why people point out, and that part is true, that instead of eating turkey, though they probably had some turkey too, because they described that the fowl was very abundant in at that time and in that place, which means they had wild turkeys. And yes, they shot them and ate them. And they also feasted on the deer. And this was at a time with the great chief Massasoit, who had concluded an alliance that lasted for more than 50 years, in which the Pilgrims, as their settlement grew and developed, helped to protect the Wampanoags, and the Wampanoags helped the Pilgrims in some of their rare, but they were there, defenses against Indian violence. And by the way, most of that Indian violence was against the group, and it was a substantial group. There were 14 towns in Massachusetts alone, 14 separate towns that were established by praying Indians. That was the term that they used for Indians who had accepted Christianity, who had become Christians. There's a in Meshaw, they have a, to this day, a meeting house, an Indian meeting house, it's called, which was an Indian church that was built together with the help from their Pilgrim neighbors in 1684. So you're talking 100 years before the American Revolution. And yet he relates, Giassi Ross, this author, rapper, speaker, and storyteller, and Indian activist, he relates the Thanksgiving with genocide and violence and the prison industrial complex. Listen, this is 8C.
They brought chattel slavery to Africans and Native people. That still happens through the prison industrial complex that imprisons the descendants of enslaved Africans and Natives at far disparate numbers. Far disparate. That is the reality of Thanksgiving. Many of us are still waiting for white America, waiting for Indians to bring some value, still waiting for white America to match the mythology of Thanksgiving. Freedom, justice, equality, reparations for 2.5 billion acres of stolen Native land, reparations for 246 years of stolen labor, reparations for stealing Native children. Stop the killing. It's still happening. Stop the theft. It's still happening. Return the land. Match the mythology. Then, and only then, we can all be equally thankful.
Okay, the idea that the land is entirely stolen, or we're still waiting for white people to bring something of value, there are those of us, and I not only admit this, I assert this proudly. I am proud of the civilization that our forefathers, including those Native Americans, and it's a huge percentage of the total Native American population, that identified as Americans, and not as a separate Indian identity, but part of the whole national fabric. And the notion that nothing of value was brought by the greatest nation in the world, that has rescued the world from massive starvation, genocide, tyranny, again and again and again in our history. Boy, is that sad. And just to get back to a moment, we need to get into some kind of perspective, it seems to me, maybe before Thanksgiving, and with the Arbery verdict, I think we very well may. There is a, right now, this stark contrast just waiting to happen between what people say to slander America and to ignore all of the progress on race and justice and basically just the choices we have in our lives and the cause of liberty and decency, that cause has been advanced in America over the last 300 years, 400 years since the pilgrims arrived, 400 years since the first Thanksgiving. And to deny that and to ignore that progress is horrible. The defense lawyer for the accused killers in the Ahmaud Arbery murder trial also offered his closing arguments. And you can see right away where they fall short. Listen, this is clip 19.
This is where the law is intertwined with heartache and tragedy. You are allowed to defend yourself. You are allowed to use force that is likely to cause death or serious bodily injury if you believe it's necessary. At that moment, Travis believed it was necessary. This is a law that is for a person in Travis's situation.
Okay. If you believe it is necessary, he did a little ellipses there. If you believe it is necessary, dot, dot, dot. The law says if you believe it is necessary to prevent your own bodily harm or death. That's the sense in which you are permitted to use deadly force. And that was exactly the basis for Kyle Rittenhouse being acquitted. And it is the basis on which it is impossible to argue that Travis and the other McMichael, with the three defendants here, have any basis at all for claiming that they were acting in self-defense. You are not permitted to use force, deadly force, because you believe somebody else has been in previous visits ripping off or breaking into the property of your neighbors. You have the right to try to call the police. That's why we have police. And by the way, it doesn't matter whether he was justified in believing the worst about Ahmaud Arbery. By the way, he wasn't. Clearly wasn't. But what you have is a situation in which there is clearly one party in a confrontation that is trying to avoid violence, that is not looking for violence. And the other part of the conversation that is spoiling for a fight. It's as the prosecutor said very eloquently, who brought the rifle to the party? Who began using guns against an unarmed man who was trapped and running away? We will find out. The verdict should be, God willing, soon. We will be right back on the Medved Show. And on the Michael Medved Show, combining some of the biggest concerns of the moment, which have to do with inflation, a lot of people getting ready for Thanksgiving, of course, and trying to celebrate some of the joys of this country while keeping in mind some of the insanity that was on display so horribly over the weekend in Waukesha, Wisconsin, and also recognizing, as Ken Burns urges us to do in a statement, recognizing some of the violent and some of the dark episodes of America's past, which are there and are real, but they do not include, repeat, do not include anything involving the founding of Massachusetts. And then somebody's going to bring up the so-called Pequot Massacre, the Mystic Massacre of 1637, 17 years after the Pilgrims landed, in which basically there were very heavy casualties for some settlers in Connecticut And in other towns in Massachusetts, where a significant percentage of the population was actually killed, and there was a war and there was a battle. And the battle was primarily fought by Indians on both sides. And the Indians with which the Pilgrims were allied were successful. And the results weren't pretty. And does that represent the standard policy of the Puritan and Pilgrim settlers? It does not. And the claim that it does, and this is the essence of what they were about, that they came here, this basically goes to the whole idea that people are arguing about with Kyle Rittenhouse at the moment. Kyle Rittenhouse, it was very clear, did not come to the streets of Kenosha, Wisconsin. He did not come there with the intention of wreaking violence or of killing people. That wasn't, and now why did he bring a gun? He brought a gun to defend himself, which is basically why he got off, because there was absolutely, he was charged with the Wisconsin equivalent of first-degree murder. First-degree murder means a pre-planning and prior intent to actually kill somebody. And there's no evidence at all that Kyle Rittenhouse was involved with that. The same is true. You can say that some of the Spanish conquistadors who conquered Mexico and conquered Peru and conquered some of the major Indian civilization and did kill thousands upon thousands of people, that there was certainly a desire to create military victory, but the Pilgrims and the Puritans, who wrote extensively about their plans and their plans for building a new Jerusalem, which they sought, they did not include Indian massacres. And there was no intent of that kind of extraordinarily loathsome activity. Okay, so Kyle Rittenhouse right now apparently is going to be speaking tonight on Fox News. And they have released some of his statements. Obviously, it's provocative. This is not necessarily all that Kyle Rittenhouse will say. But on the Tucker Carlson show later this evening, apparently it will include excerpts like this. This is clip 6.
This case has nothing to do with race. It never had anything to do with race. It had to do with the right to self-defense.
Right.
I'm not a racist person. I support the BLM movement. I support peacefully demonstrating. And I believe there needs to be change. I believe there's a lot of prosecutorial misconduct, not just in my case, but in other cases. And it's just amazing to see how much a prosecutor can take advantage of somebody.
Okay, does that sound unreasonable? And again, there is no evidence that describing Rittenhouse as a white supremacist, which the president did almost casually while he was a candidate for president of the United States. This is back more than a year ago. But it's simply wrong. And then Kyle Rittenhouse offers this in the broadcast that will be played tonight. This is clip 2.
It wasn't Kyle Rittenhouse on trial in Wisconsin. It was the right to self-defense on trial.
Right.
And if I was convicted, no one would ever be privileged to defend their life against attackers.
That, of course, is an overstatement, but that would have been the impact. In other words, this was such a clear self-defense case where he was literally struggling over the gun from somebody in the case of Rosenbaum, who died, but he had grabbed the barrel of the gun and was struggling to get control of it. And what Kyle Rittenhouse is saying is basically true, which is if you want to say that I did not have the right to defend myself, then no one in no situation has a right to defend himself or herself. But that doesn't persuade the Vice President of the United States, who, by the way, continues to plummet in the ratings in terms of her poll results to such an extent that there really is serious talk of the division between the so-called Harris team, the Vice President's team in the White House, her staff, and the White House team, and talk of desire to shut her out as much as possible of the Biden administration. Should probably be very helpful to the Biden administration. On late Friday afternoon, Kamala Harris, the Vice President of the United States, spoke to the media about her view of the Rittenhouse verdict. Listen.
Hey, guys. Well, it was a good trip, and they have questions about the verdict, and the verdict really speaks for itself. As many of you know, I've spent a majority of my career working to make the criminal justice system more equitable, and clearly there's a lot more work to do.
Okay. To make it more equitable, and clearly there's a lot more work to do, in what sense is the Rittenhouse verdict inequitable? Well, Tiffany Cross, unhinged, of MSNBC, has her statement on that, clip 10.
Disgusted at what I'm seeing. It's not just this trial, it's other trials, but this in particular, the fact that white supremacists roam the halls of Congress freely and celebrate this little murderous white supremacist, and the fact that he gets to walk the streets freely, it lets you know these people have access to instituting laws. They represent the legislative branch of this country. What are we to make of that?
Welcome to the modern Republican Party. This is what these people want.
Okay. My challenge, and by the way, callers, the phones are open, and we'll get to you, and we'll get you even if we have to hang on at some point. But anybody want to offer some proof, some evidence, the slightest bit of evidence, that Kyle Rittenhouse was a white supremacist? Anything he said, anything he posted, you know, if it existed, it would have been brought up by people like Tiffany Cross, as the resources of MSNBC and NBC News behind her. It is completely wrong. And the other day, we were talking about a piece that had been written by Nick Sandman. Remember from the Covington, Kentucky group, he was wearing a MAGA hat, and therefore he had been smeared in the media, and he sued. And he actually recovered some money in judgments. And a number of people have suggested that Kyle Rittenhouse ought to do the same thing. When I hear something like this from Tiffany Cross, it is so reckless, it is so damaging, and it would be so hard for her to prove. In other words, the legal standard is if she shows a reckless disregard of the truth, calling him a little white supremacist is defamatory. I mean, it's clearly defamatory today, and especially to someone like Rittenhouse, who makes it clear even now, several days after the verdict, that no, he had no white supremacy intentions at all. And after all, the most fundamental thing, the people who died while attacking Kyle Rittenhouse were all white, every one of them. So the idea that there is racism here, putting racism into everything, is a disaster for America. Who says so? One of America's foremost black scholars, the great John McWhorter, will be joining us coming up in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.